Homily 35, Jesus and Politics. Render to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God. This morning's gospel is one of my favorites. Humberto Sousa Medeiros, the late Bishop of Brownsville, Texas, and then Cardinal Archbishop of Boston, was widely praised for his untiring work on behalf of Texas's migrant farm workers, the poor, and prisoners. He also opposed the Vietnam War, strongly supported busing, refused to let parents enroll their children in parochial schools as a means of avoiding it, and spoke out against racism in certain Boston communities. However, when the cardinal called abortion a horrendous crime and deadly sin, he was severely criticized as violating the so-called separation of church and state. The supporters of the alleged wall of separation between church and state have a special love of this morning's gospel, in which Jesus said, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God." Notice the trick question of Jesus' enemies. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? Jesus answered no. The Herodians would have charged Jesus with treason against Rome. If yes, the Pharisees would have accused Jesus of disloyalty to the occupied Jewish nation, and he would lose the support of the people. Think of the Pope in Burma, Myanmar, not using the word Rohingya. He was also put on the spot. Notice, in asking his enemies to produce a coin, Jesus knew that the Roman coin had Caesar's graven image on it. Graven images forbidden to Jews. With the inscription, a blasphemous inscription, Augustus Tiberius, son of the divine Augustus and high priest. Thus, Jesus drew attention to the blasphemous image and writings and turned the tables on them. In proclaiming, "Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God," Jesus was essentially saying, "Send this filthy sacrilegious stuff back where it came from." However, and I like this, Jesus' brilliant retort also echoed the slogan of the Jewish Maccabean revolt against the Syrians: pay back the Gentiles what they deserve. When the neighborhood bully challenged me to a boxing match, my father said, "Give him what he deserves." In other words, Jesus' words could have been interpreted by the subjugated Jews with respect to Caesar as, "Give him as good as you've gotten." So his reply was ambiguous. What Jesus did not mean was dividing human life and the world into two segments, the religious and the political. This skewed 18th century Enlightenment view, bolstered by Immanuel Kant's division of the sphere of justice from that of religion, would prevent any Christian criticism of unjust public policy, including economic policy, which is sometimes sorely needed in this world. I'm astonished at how readily the liberal media will praise and embrace the church's profound social doctrine and then tell the church to shut up on other matters. It's often asserted that religion is a purely private matter. However, the mistranslated biblical text, "The kingdom of God is within you," better translates as, "The kingdom of God is in your midst," or "The kingdom of God is within your grasp." Notice, the Jewish people, and Jesus was Jewish, never considered the kingdom of God as a purely spiritual, private, interior relationship with God. The kingdom of God always referred to God's sovereign plan to transform the world to make everything right. And something that also happens, of course, in the public world. Moreover, the mistranslation of Jesus' statement, "My kingdom is not of this world," more accurately translates as, "My kingdom is not from this world." But, "My kingdom is not the sort that grows in this world." The way to kingship in the ancient world was either through family lineage or by violence. For example, 30 years before Jesus' birth, King Herod the Great had defeated the Parthians, and because of Roman gratitude, he became the despised king of the Jews, to which he had no right. In front of Pilate, Jesus certainly agreed that he had a kingdom, a statement that Pilate immediately seized upon. But Jesus was hardly stating that his kingdom had nothing to do at all with the present world. "Thy kingdom come on earth," he taught his disciples to pray. Although Jesus denies that his kingdom had such a worldly origin or quality, the world in John's Gospel, for example, is understood as a source of evil and rebellion against God, Jesus is not denying that his kingdom is for this world. And Jesus answered Pilate, "You say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth." Pilate scoffed with the question, "What's truth?" I had a high school English teacher, and I have a mental image of him right now. We used to call him Canvasback Kylie because he used to be a boxer. The girls were all in love with him. So this high school English teacher, who on the basis of Jesus' silence to Pilate's question said, "Not even Jesus knew what truth is." However, this teacher had no knowledge of the irony in John's Gospel. Had not Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life"? Irony. Truth incarnate stands before Pilate, and he doesn't recognize it. Had Jesus preached only an interior kingdom, the religious political establishment would have hardly crucified him. Neither would have the apostles, Paul, Peter, the early Christians, faced riots, imprisonment, and eventually the death penalty if all they were doing were teaching people timeless ethical truths or a non-political, dehistoricized view of the kingdom. Like Jesus, their vision of the kingdom and future consummation remains emphatically about the transformation of this world. And this was political dynamite. Because the church exists for the sake of the kingdom of God, one of justice, peace, and freedom, the church's mission must also include responsibility for humanization in its fullest sense, activities on behalf of social justice and human rights. I had to point out to a former graduate student who was strongly opposed to Christian involvement in politics that this is not only justified but also mandatory because of the social and institutional character of evil itself. Christianity possesses a prophetic dimension, which echoes that of the Jewish prophets, who did not hesitate to castigate kings and others of authority. In the struggle for social justice, peace, and human rights is an essential constitutive duty of Christians. Are we not social beings? Religion cannot be a purely private matter. Love of neighbor, without which there is really no love of God, requires all Christians to be conscious of their duty in the world on behalf of the dignity of the individual and in defense of justice against institutionalized injustice. Christianity's eschatological hope for the age to come always entails a relativizing and questioning of existing social structures. Look around. It's obvious. Things are far from perfect. To conclude, Christian faith and love has a deeply social and political dimension. In common with all citizens, Christians have the right, the duty to participate in the sphere of public life. In the name of freedom and tolerance, Christians can rightly demand that not only those opposed to Christian values be permitted to have a voice in the public forum. In the words of the prophet Micah, do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with God.